Welcome to the sixth episode of season three of the Ubuntu UK podcast. It's quite late on Monday, the 26th of April, 2010. And in this episode, we are going to review two tiny computers. We'll talk about the gap between Ubuntu and Debian developers. We will, of course, cover the latest news, events, bit about Ubuntu, and go over your feedback. I'm Tony, and there's three people with me here this evening. I'm looking around the room, and I'm going to say hello to Simon.
Good evening.
Good evening. How are you doing?
I'm tired.
Yeah?
We've been waffling for hours. Yeah. I've been here since 7:30.
We call that the pre-show.
Okay, we've been caring and sharing.
Uh-huh.
Feeling the love.
It's been fun.
Well, it has been. Yeah. So what have you been up to in the recent days?
A couple of things. I've been doing a bit more bug work, which has been fun. And not fun.
Say it again like you mean it.
Well, it has been fun, but it's not been fun, which is why we're doing the seg today, because I've been getting incredibly frustrated.
Right.
Although I've actually had an answer today, which actually makes the seg go away, but I think it's important to discuss it. So my frustration has been resolved.
So what you're saying is you're wrong, but we're still going to talk about it.
No, I'm not wrong. I've just learned.
Just going to list
it's an
the
important
ways.
Thing. And the other thing I've done is I've set up a mirror at home.
Oh, cool.
Which I've not done before. And that's probably a segment itself, but
a lucid mirror.
A lucid mirror, which downloaded 60 gig, which is big.
Is that really worthwhile?
Well,
how many machines do you have that run lucid?
I will have 5 at home. So it is, and you've got to bear in mind that when I'm doing the bug work, I'm actually using VMs. So
doing reinstalls.
So it does make sense. But with Meerkat rapidly coming, I'll have to do another 60 gig download fairly shortly. But it's been fun learning.
I run a mirror purely because the bandwidth here is not all that great, so that when I do want to install a big package, I've not got to wait for hours for it to download.
Yeah,
that's my reason.
Think yourselves lucky. I usually install packages at work when I'm on GPRS. It's like dial-up. It's horrid.
If I did it at work, I wouldn't have a problem. I've got 100 megabit fibre. But anyway. Go. And so Alan's here as well.
Hello.
Boasting about his GPRS speed.
Yes, how are you?
I'm not too bad, What have you been doing? Have you been playing with anything interesting?
I've been playing with my juggler still.
Cool.
And other people's breaking other people's jugglers as well. And I've got, you know, I keep going on about this Drobo thing.
Yeah.
I got a new one.
Ooh.
Buy a new one. I got a replacement.
You've got two.
The warranty was running out. And it was really noisy. It used to be on my desk, and it was too noisy, and I was trying to record screencasts and do, like, Skype calls and stuff, and it was just right next to my ear. So I moved it under the desk, and it was still under the desk. So I've now moved it 3 doors away into the utility room on top of the fridge in the middle of the house, and I can still hear it.
Wow.
And when I go to bed, I'm standing above it, and I can hear the house going...
Sure, it's not just your laptop.
No, this was the Drobo. Oh, actually, also, I cleaned out the laptop, and that doesn't make any noise either.
Wow.
So I got a new Drobo, and it's quieter and faster.
And just as a piece of background information, you've got 2 kids, so it's making more noise than they are put together.
Yeah, well, when they're asleep,
Oh, right, okay.
Well, not during the day, no.
That's quite spectacular.
Yeah.
Cool, and last but not least, Laura, hi.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm all right, thank you.
Good.
I've spent the day doing usability testing.
Oh, right, at work.
At work,
very good.
But specifically group usability testing, which was quite interesting because I had 4 people to observe at once, which is okay until they decide to split into 2 groups.
Ah.
And then you've got to follow 2 conversations at once and take lots of meaningful notes.
The people's front of user testing and the user testing people's front, is it? Right,
yeah, okay. Well, it made sense and stuff, but no, it's quite good because people tend to work on things in groups or by interacting over IRC or whatever, so it actually makes a lot of sense.
Wicked. Well, I'm glad you had a productive day. I've not been doing very much. I handed in my last essay for a few weeks last week, and then I've been kind of ramping up on OddCamp, which we'll talk more about a bit later. But there's no Dave this week, so we'll just dive right into the content.
Sounds like a fun packed show.
We had a little mini review from Matt Daubney, and he sent it to us, so let's play a bit of it now.
The Acer Aspire Revo R3600 is a small form factor nettop, which is a small, low-powered computer. This one is powered by an Intel Atom 230, which is a 1.6 GHz single-core processor. It comes with a gigabyte of RAM, a single 160 GB laptop-style hard drive, 802.11n wireless networking, loads of USB inputs, an eSATA port, a single VGA output, a single gigabit LAN socket and an HDMI output. The HDMI output is powered through the onboard NVIDIA Ion integrated graphics card. When you first power it on, the unit should come up with a Linux variant. However, the first time I booted mine, it just booted to a screen full of 99s and then stopped and asked for boot media. This didn't trouble me too much, as I simply created a USB boot disk using a standard Ubuntu Live CD, stuck it straight in the box, and it booted from that. The nice thing of using the Live CD was it proved that everything in the box just worked. Using the box as a home office machine seems quite reasonable. OpenOffice will run quite happily along with Firefox and Evolution at the same time. If you pushed it much more than this, I suspect you'd start to get judderiness and slowdown as the little atom tries to keep up with you. The one thing that the Live CD didn't run on boot was the NVIDIA binary driver. This is required in order to use the HDMI output. The integrated Ion graphics card allows you to play back HD video even at 1080p. This is despite the fact that the unit only comes with a single core 1.6 GHz processor.
A few of us have got these little hardware devices and we wanted to talk about a couple of them.
Yes. I think, has everybody got a Revo?
Nope.
No, not Simon.
No.
Dave has one. I've got one. I've got two, actually.
Yeah, so you've got more than one.
Actually, no, I've got three.
That's quite sad. I've only got the one.
Actually, technically, one of them my mum has.
Right. They are very nice, I have to say. Mm. I use mine as a media box. So it runs Myth TV, front end and back end. HDMI output straight into the HD telly.
Yeah.
Lovely stuff.
So what is it? It's a small PC, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, Matt's have described a bit of some of the internal specs on it, but it's beefy enough for the job, and it's physically small. I mean, it's next to the Wii underneath the telly, and it looks very similar to that in terms of its overall bulk. So it's quite discreet, tucks in there, compared with the big boxy PC that it replaced, which I'm sure you'll remember used to sort of sit on the top there, a big grey silver thing. It's sweet.
Actually, you can attach it to the back of the screen.
Yes, it comes with a little kind of plate, doesn't it?
Yeah, I've got one in the bedroom, and it's attached to the back of the telly in the bedroom.
I haven't done that. I don't know why.
No, I don't know why either. I don't know why you haven't attached it to your telly.
To get to.
Yeah, I guess there is that.
Once you've plugged it in, you don't need to get to it. It's kind of just like clunk, and you can easily unclip it and clip it back on.
Oh, right.
It's not permanent. You just and pull it off.
Yeah, I might have to have a look at that.
I need to sort that out. I wouldn't like that noise.
You don't like that noise?
No.
Right. Don't pull it off then.
Okay.
Simple.
But I got the audio going over HDMI straight into the TV, so that works as well. And literally, I mean, when I first started playing with Myth TV, it took me days to get a basic functioning system. But with a Revo and Mythbuntu, thanks to Dave and his cronies, it just was done inside a day. And that some of that was fiddling around that I wouldn't normally have had to do because I was tweaking stuff.
Yeah, when I first got mine, it was running Karmic, and I had a few issues with it, but I ran Boxy, and I used that to watch video that I'd got on my network shared drive thing, and used the remote control, and it just worked, and up, down, left, right, fire, watch the program, and it watches, and it's NVIDIA, so you need the binary driver.
It's got the special accelerated technology that is VDPAU?
That's the Badger, excellent. Yes. Basically offloads the video playback to the GPU. So it looks really nice. I know a lot of people have got these kind of NVIDIA Ion based things, and they all seem to work okay if you don't mind having the evil NVIDIA driver.
When you say they work okay, they seem to be great as media players. Are they good as PCs?
Well, it's funny you should say that. My mum has one as her PC.
Oh, right.
And, her uses started. So far, she's used it for surfing the web a little bit, Wikipedia, that kind of stuff. Playing back music and stuff like that. And nothing really too heavyweight. So as a light, you know, average user, I know we keep saying there's no such thing as an average user, but I think there is. And I think they're okay for average users.
And you're a speaking saw.
Sorry, yes, exactly. So I'm right.
I mean, it's a similar sort of spec to a netbook, really, isn't it? It's a netbook in a different form factor.
Yeah, it is exactly the same as a netbook. Yeah.
So anything you could do with a netbook...
Although most netbooks don't, well, they are starting to, but most netbooks don't have these NVIDIA video cards.
No, true.
So it's actually a bit more pokey than a And it's also got eSATA. So if you wanted to plug an external SATA hard drive into it, then you've got that. And it's got an SD card slot, loads of USB ports, five USB ports, I think. Six USB ports, in fact. One of them's blocked up. I don't know why.
Yeah, I noticed
that's
that.
That's weird.
I haven't poked around to see if I can work
Maybe
out.
It's disconnected on the inside.
Yeah,
no, it works, actually. If you just get a screwdriver and pop the little rubber bung in, it works. For some reason, I had to do that. I can't remember why. I had to have six things plugged into it. I don't know what it was.
USB hub?
Yeah. That would be good.
Is the USB remote... Is it USB the remote that you've plugged into on?
Yes, I bought a USB remote. My old media box had one PCI card and one USB tuner for the Freeview, but obviously this thing can't take PCI cards, so I had to get... I was just using the USB one, and the remote control for the USB one doesn't have half the buttons you need for Myth TV. So Alan recommended a generic kind of media center remote off of eBay. Turned up, and with a little bit of jiggery-pokery to get the key mappings right, it was job done. So
one of the flaws I think Dave's mentioned about that remote, or the whole USB remote thing, is you can't wake the thing up. So if you shut it down or suspend it, you can't wake it.
I can go one better than that.
From USB, what?
Press the power button, and the whole thing kernel panics.
Oh, nice.
The kernel panic button.
Really? Yeah.
it's lit up as well.
It's so red.
Two features.
Yeah. But other than that, it works very well. Yeah. A minor feature.
Have you filed a bug?
I haven't, no.
Is that because you hate Launchpad?
I don't hate Launchpad.
Really?
I had a couple of tweets from Graham Binns, telling me how I should report bugs. And it's great if you know a Launchpad developer.
But
I still think my point generally stands.
Cool.
But yes, so sorry.
Generally, if you're going to, out of five, rate the Revo for what you use it for?
For what I use it for, a four.
Why would it need another star?
I've had... It crashed once, and it's a little bit worrying when it's your media thing, and TV is very important to me, obviously. Four and a half. Let's go 4.5.
Yeah.
You're right, yeah. It's pretty good. It's pretty good. I like it a lot.
And they're pretty cheap as well.
That's
150 quid.
Absolutely. And you can get it with Windows, which is more expensive, can't you?
And they do a dual-core version as well, with the Atom 330 CPU.
But yes.
If you wanted a more pokey desktop PC. Although... arguable whether two cores makes it more pokey or more clock. I don't know.
But yeah, so I think it's good. What about you?
Yeah, probably about the same. Four.
For what it is.
Yeah, it's a nice little PC.
Yeah. Go on then. So somebody else has been playing with an Alusha.
Yeah, I've had an Alusha T1.
That's right, yeah. And you've had a play with it. What do you think?
Is that the one that you brought the other week?
No.
Yeah.
Black...
Shall I run the specs?
Yeah, go on.
This is slightly different than the spec you get on the site. Came with 2 gig of RAM, an Atom N270 CPU, which is the same 1.6 gigahertz that you get in everything. Intel video card. It's got a VGA and a DVI output on the back, but no HDMI. And it ours came with a 40 gig hard drive.
Do you know what it retails at?
No.
Okay, I'll find that out while you talk.
The interesting thing about this one that's slightly different is that it's got wireless built in.
As does the Revo.
Oh, does it?
Yes. It's not so obvious on the Revo because the Alusha has an aerial sticking out.
Yeah, that's as far as I'm concerned, that's a good thing because you've got a socket on the back. So you could, in fact, if you wanted to use it as a server, you could put a decent aerial on it.
It's a kind of like access, turn it into an access point and a server all in one.
So you could make a mirror. I'm thinking about Oldcamp this weekend. I was thinking about taking a mirror, and that would be perfect because you could, in theory, turn it into a wireless access point with a mirror on board.
Mm.
Sounds like a very good idea.
I did make a slight flaw when I got it out of the box and screwed the aerial into the thing and then realised that the aerial fouls all the ports on the back. And then realised that's because I had it upside down. And the aerial's supposed to be at the top, not the bottom, fouling all the ports.
No, I haven't had the opportunity to give the T1 a proper kind of road test. I've only looked at it out of the box, but it's industrial in its manufacturing,
it is.
Isn't it?
It's not cute like the Revo.
It looks like it's about to go in a rack.
Yeah.
Or be mounted above a ceiling tile or something like that.
There's a little bit of inconsistency on the colours as well. So you know how they colour ports?
Right.
And some of the ports are coloured and some of them aren't. Right. So you know how you have like purple for
keyboard
and green for something else, and it just annoyed me slightly that not all of the ports were coloured. The ones on the front are. I don't think the ones on the back aren't.
Mm. Well, it's
because you can't see them.
That would, yeah.
And okay. It's designed to go on the back of your TV monitor.
Same sort of thing.
True. Yeah. So yeah. It doesn't matter that it looks a bit sort of black boxy.
Yeah, but, I mean, I don't mind it being black boxy. I think it's just kind of a different feel. I'd feel much more safe in it being somewhere a bit more exposed, perhaps, because of its construction.
Mm-hmm. It looks a bit more solid than the Aspire, doesn't it? The Revo.
I don't. Well, yeah, okay. The Revo feels a bit plasticky.
Mm.
But I think the Revo still feels pretty solid. But yeah. the Alusha came with, unlike the Revo came with no operating system. It had the Splashtop Linux on the ROM, no operating system at all, which was nice. But even nicer, the Alusha came with Ubuntu pre-installed. Karmic it came with. And it was just four clicks of the mouse, you know, enter your name, what region are you, time zone, job done.
I just had a quick look on their website. I can't remember how much RAM you said that particular
it
one
came
we've
with
got.
2 gig.
Came with 2 gig. Okay. The basic price then, at the moment they're showing it lists with 10.4 in pre-installed, which is quite clever because it's not out yet.
Well, maybe they'll send them out the second it releases.
Basically, the price would be just over £200 for the 2 gig version with a 40 gig hard drive. The spec you've just
is
said.
That with the Wi-Fi adapter.
That's with the Wi-Fi.
That's the other weird thing.
I was about to say the great thing about the T1 is you can upgrade it yourself. I don't know if you can whip the back off the Revo and yank bits, but you certainly
not really.
Can on the T1. It's definitely built as sort of a.
Yeah, I opened it up to have a look at how the Wi-Fi was connected, and it's a mini PCI Express or whatever they call it.
Yeah.
And one of the other options you can get with the T1 is you can get a 1080p playback module as an option. But there's two problems with that. One, if you go for that, you lose the wireless because it's the same port.
Right.
So you either have wireless or you have the 1080p playback module.
Yep.
And the other problem is it doesn't have HDMI out.
Yeah, that's a bit of a shame. But it's got DVI, so you could do DVI to HDMI conversion.
And then you'd need to have the audio coming out of the sound card. Yeah. So it's doable. It's doable. And it's quite a nice little machine.
And has a 2.5-inch drive on the inside, which, of course, is easily updatable as well, upgradable.
And it's quiet as well.
It's fanless, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's completely silent. So Whereas the Revo has a fan on the GPU and doesn't kick in usually until it's really, you know, going for it.
Mm. I suppose the metal case of the T1 helps it cool because it's essentially a big heat sink.
Yeah.
The hard drive is actually screwed to the lid.
Oh, right.
So when you unscrew it and take it apart, not that I've unscrewed and taken it apart, but when you take the part, yeah, I did too. when you lift the lid off, the hard drive is screwed to the lid and everything else is on the base. It's quite nice.
So is it a similar sort of netbook type motherboard with bits on? It sounds like it's a bit different from a netbook.
It's a little bit different, but it's...
Is it a mini ITX? Having never ever seen one, it's...
I don't know. No, because all the ports are laid out a bit different. I don't think it's a standard mini ITX type motherboard, but it's, you know, it's got plenty of ports and it seemed to perform pretty well.
Yeah.
Excellent.
It's quick enough.
So of the two, if you were looking for one for, say, for your mum.
Well, you see, the way the Alusha has it is that you don't have evil NVIDIA binary drivers. It's all Intel.
Right. So it's all with the 3D, but it's all...
Well, not with the... When you say 3D, it's Intel video card.
Yeah. So does that have 3D acceleration?
It comes with... Compiz is enabled by default,
Compiz,
yes.
Right, okay.
So, yeah, you get 3D desktop effects and that kind of stuff.
Excellent.
But, so if you were going to do video playback, then maybe the Alusha with the playback module might be good.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that the Revo has HDMI out meant that it's just one cable, plug it in there, plug it in the telly, job done.
If I was going to go for a media server, I'd go for the Revo. But if I was going to... buy something sort of possibly home servery or
maybe
firewall.
A desktop or
networky
type stuff.
I'd go for the T1.
Yeah.
Actually, that's quite interesting. That's one thing I haven't tried is it'd be interesting to know if the Alusha gets the same sort of shearing that I get with my Revo on full screen video playback.
Oh,
watching preview, I get only on like when you're very fast pans, you start to notice a little bit of shearing on the picture.
Yeah, I get that as well.
Even over HDMI. It'd be interesting to know if the Alusha has the same problem or whether that solves it.
You should give us some feedback on the next show.
Well, it also the guys are going to be at OggCamp.
Yes, this is true,
so we can ask them questions like this.
And in fact, they will be giving away a T1 and a D1. The D1 is a slightly different form factor, which I'm very hurriedly just trying to see if I can find. It's a mini Atom PC. So I think it's even...
Oh, that's the teeny tiny one, isn't it?
Yeah, it's even diddlier. Diddlier? Is that a word?
Yeah, yeah,
than
it is
the T1, although it's got an optical drive and things in it, so it's a bit more of a desktop-y form factor. But yeah, so two nice little bits of kit, actually. The United States Library of Congress has acquired the entire archive of public tweets from Twitter. Google have also introduced real-time searches of Twitter timelines.
Is that good?
The Republic of Congress, Library of Congress thing. I'm not sure.
I think Twitter and Dentica and all that microblogging is very ephemeral, and you see it and then it goes away. I can't remember how many times I've wanted to go back and reread stuff.
But there's lots of good profiling stuff in that.
That's true.
And the Google thing for that, but the archive thing was so they could do studies on social interests and things in future.
It's all profiling. And when they tag that to your Facebook account, and then they go to Google and they check you out there and they know you and they've never even met you.
The Library of Congress is one of those libraries that has one copy of everything that was published, I think, in America. So this is presumably some sort of extension of that. You think, well, actually, who wants a load of old dross about people going, but I did this, or look at this website? But then presumably they've got a lot of old dross in the publishing archive as well.
Yeah. So in 100 years' time, students will be studying this Twitter thing that we all used to do and looking at our conversations.
Even in 4 years' time, they'll look back at all the general election stuff and see what the excitement was on Twitter and the digital economy bill.
And how it shaped the world.
Yeah, or not. Sharp have announced another mobile internet device running Ubuntu 9.04. The NetWalker PC T1 has a 5-inch screen supporting 1024 by 600 and a Freescale CPU.
It looks quite shiny.
It does, doesn't it?
Yes. It's not a million miles away from some of the Nokia sort of N900 in feel, although it's got a stylus and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I quite like one.
I had a play with their previous one. The PC Z1. I think, and had a play with that at UDS, one of the guys there. Really high resolution and a tiny, tiny, tiny screen.
Yeah, and that had a keyboard, though, I think.
Yeah, and it fitted in your pocket.
And this new one hasn't. It's got the right-on-screen type keyboard.
I quite like the one with the keyboard. I mean, it was really, really ridiculously tiny. But the guy who had it as an Ubuntu developer, and he just slipped it into his shirt pocket, his suit pocket, and, like, pulled out this PC. It's a full-on PC running Ubuntu, not... like one of these cut down shonky operating systems like Android.
But what can you do with it?
I was going to say, what's it for?
You can do whatever you would do with a computer, can't you?
Except it's really small. So is it meant to be like a PDA? Or?
It's a mobile internet device.
Yeah, you do what you like with it. Browse the web, get your email.
It's like the iPad.
Usual stuff.
Bit like my HTC design.
No, it's not.
It's nothing like the iPad.
iPad's bigger, isn't it?
But ugly for a start.
Did you see Blendtec with the iPad?
Blending it?
Yeah. Will it blend? Oh, it did. Right, antivirus vendor McAfee, love this one, made several people's weeks run much harder recently when their software falsely identified a core Windows process as a virus, causing entire networks to shut down.
Whoops.
Yeah, I felt sorry for them in a way, but then also that internally had that little chuckle.
You just know there's a whole heap of technicians who are wandering around with CDs and USB sticks keys, trying to get thousands of computers back online. And it was obviously pushed out in the corporate world a lot quicker, where they have these centralized update servers that they check. And we're the same at work. You know, we've got a core update server for our AV. It checks every hour.
But if we were on every desktop, we'd have to have some kind of protection, and it's entirely plausible this kind of thing could happen on Linux as well.
Could, so your smugness would be misplaced.
Mm.
But it doesn't stop you being smug now.
I'm not really smug. I'm just kind of... I don't know. It's difficult, really, because I know friends who've had to deal with this kind of rubbish, but I don't know, there's something nice about... Like, I've told you before about when I was in America and I sat on my Linux PC and the two guys near me were infected with viruses on their PCs, and they were completely... unable to do any work because their machines were rebooting all the time. So they went off and played golf. Now, arguably, that's nice for them and not nice for me, although I don't play golf. But the fact is, I was able to carry on working and they weren't. You know, So there is a level of smugness that
there's a perspective there.
Yeah, it's like, I'm a glass half full kind of guy. So, yeah, I think it was a good thing.
Fair enough.
We've got some upcoming events, and very soon we have some release parties.
Ooh.
All around the world, but specifically in the UK, there's going to be one in London, one in Banbury, near Oxford, I think that is.
Yep.
There's a first one in Scotland, I believe.
Excellent.
And there isn't going to be one in Manchester, I don't think. There was last year.
Right.
But I think most of the people from Manchester are coming over to Ogcamp in Liverpool, because it's nearby-ish. And you can get a list of all of the release parties around the world if you go to wiki.ubuntu.com/lucidreleaseparties. Or that handy URL that I set up last year, which is houseparty.cx.
Does that still direct to the right place?
Yes, I edited it so it does.
Brilliant. Okay, sounds like worth going along to.
So are you going to any other than Ogcamp?
Yeah, I'm going to the London one.
May go to the London one.
Yeah. It's good fun. The downside of the London one is it's almost always in a noisy bar, which is good and bad.
So what do you do at a release party?
Drink beer and fall over.
Okay, what does everybody else do at a release party?
Watch me fall over.
Do you hand out CDs to unsuspecting passers-by?
Actually, I tried at one a few years ago in one of the bars in London, and this couple came over and they said, what are you lot all doing here? And I said, oh, we've just had this new product that we put out, new version. And they said, oh yeah, what's that then? And I started explaining, and she was there for about, I don't know, half an hour, 45 minutes while we were drinking and chatting away and asking about what it is. And then I said, I should get you a CD, actually. I couldn't find it. I didn't have any on me. And there just happened to be one guy walk past with his bag. And I said, hey, have you got an Ubuntu CD? And he went, yeah. So I grabbed it. And this is after this woman had walked away. So I grabbed the CD off him and I went off looking for her around the bar. It was quite a big bar. I eventually found her and I think she thought, oh, God, it's him again. So I just gave her the CD and walked away. So, well, yeah, it's quite nice. It's a bit of a chat.
Do you all wear Ubuntu T-shirts?
Some people do, yes.
Fair enough. Excellent. And we've also got Barcamp Blackpool coming up on the 3rd of July, which is a free unconference. You can find out more at barcampblackpool.com. It's in the Blackpool Pleasure Beach Casino.
Wow.
Apparently last year they had crowdsourced web development sessions, geocaching and Android application development, amongst other stuff.
Sounds super geeky.
Yeah, I didn't hear about it last year, but it sounds really good.
Yeah.
Get along.
We should send a roving reporter.
We should do.
The stress levels are increasing. Ogcamp is in a few days away.
Uh-huh.
Or if you're listening to this next week, it happened last weekend, and why weren't you there?
Yes. Or if you listen to it in a year, it was last... Never mind. No. It's this weekend.
Yay.
OMG.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I'm getting excited now. The last week, my excitement levels have been overtaking the worry and stress levels a bit. It's great.
We're being sent lots of really cool stuff as well.
Yes.
The raffle.
Not for us, of course.
No, sadly. It's worth just letting people know what we've got, because the raffle is one of the ways we kind of cover the cost of the event. You know, it's a unique feature, I think, in open source conferences.
Yep.
And we've been given a load of stuff. We've got 3 Vigilant NPC Ls. We've got a load of books from Wiley, the publishers. We've got 2 Alicia PCs. Different ones, I can't remember, a T1 and a D1, I think, which are these kind of tiny little form factor things. Some books and ebook vouchers from A Press, some Swish Ubuntu backpacks from the good people at Canonical, an O2 Joggler, and a 1.5 terabyte USB disk from eBuyer. So far, who knows what will arrive by the weekend.
Yes, some hubcaps, maybe.
There's a fantastic collection of geeky prizes and things to have there. So that's almost enough on its own to make me go along.
And also, there's something extra we haven't mentioned before. On the Friday, before the Ogcamp starts on the Saturday, on the Friday, we've got a Geeknik, a picnic for geeks. And it's going to be at 4 o'clock in St. John's Garden. So if you're going to be in Liverpool during the day, if you're getting there a bit early or maybe the night before, it's a great way to kickstart the weekend. And if it rains, we'll move inside to a pub or something, and that'll continue through the evening, so long as there's enough people to form a Geeknik.
Yeah, I think Laura Tchaikovsky is organising that one.
Yep. Along with many other things.
Yeah, as if she's shorter things to organise. And then that evening from 8 o'clock on the Friday night is the Rat Hole Road Show, which is Dan from the Linux Outlaws, one of his other shows that he does, which is a free culture gig at the Bad Format Club. You do need a ticket to get in. They're only a fiver, so there's not. It's not too expensive.
I think he was talking about tickets on the door as well.
Okay.
If there are any left, you'll be able to get in.
At the time of recording, there are still some left, but always check it out. And check out the Rat Hole Radio website for more information about that and the artists appearing. It's going to be fun. I'm going along. I think we all are.
Yep.
Going to go along, have a few beers. Not too many, hopefully.
Otherwise, the hangover's...
What time do we start the next day?
The doors open at 10 a.m. at the Black E for Odd Camp itself. You'll be able to find the venue thanks to the massive banners that Dan has had printed up, designed by Fab. They're going to say Odd Camp and have the little Og character.
Oh, lots of the little Ogs in different colours.
I was trying to figure out which of the Ogs was supposed to be which one of us.
I did wonder about that.
I think the purple one's probably Laura.
Yeah. I thought that.
It's her favourite colour. So... if you've got ideas, Fab set up the site. We talked about it a bit last time, ideas.ogcamp.org, where you can put any suggestions up for talks or anything like that. When you get to the event, there'll be a proper form to fill in so that people can vote on talks and things.
But yeah, this is just to give
you
people an
share
idea.
Your
of,
ideas, yeah.
Give people an idea of what's going to be happening at the event.
Yeah, there's some really interesting things on there. Mm. I know you put one up, Alan, but.
I put two up there, actually. Yeah, excellent. I've got to write them now.
Let's get going on that one then. Yeah. Can you do stuff on your laptop and drive at the same time?
Oh, how am I going to do it?
I'll be on the laptop.
I'll dictate.
He'll be driving.
Yeah.
You'll be the secretary.
Simon, make a PowerPoint for me.
I'll be in the back asleep, resting.
Guarding everything. Yes, excellent. So that's going to be kicking off. Now, that ideas.ogcamp.org had to be password protected because we got a bit of a spam attack over the weekend. But the username is everyone and the password is kill all spammers. Mm-hmm. That's all in one word. So you're welcome to log in and try that out.
And then spam it.
On Saturday night, the party after the first day is at Studio 2, which is actually really cool because I went up to Liverpool last weekend to have a look at the venue and we went to the bar to have a look around and it's really cool. it's a real recording studio and like Coldplay recorded some of their albums.
Never mind.
And famous people.
And that's actually within the venue that we're doing on Camp In.
No. Well, that's about a 5-minute walk down the road.
Cool.
And they've converted the recording studio downstairs into this bar area and they've still got the separating glass between the two parts of the bar. And then they've got
a soundproof bar, essentially.
Yeah. And then they've got two little recording booths that they've decorated and put beanbags in and stuff. It's really nice.
Why don't we have a bar that is a recording studio in Hampshire? We should do that.
We could turn your living room into one. We've got half of that done.
Half of it now. All we need now is a couple of optics on the wall and it'll be fine. But yeah, that should be good. 2 a.m. That's going to be a late night.
Yeah, that's from about 6 or 7 in the evening. Yeah. The chef's going to stay behind so we can get food there early on in the evening.
Oh, brilliant.
Yes. Which is really cool.
And there's no cost to get in?
No. It's on to the public, but everybody just turn up.
They know we're coming.
And it'll be full of geeks.
Yep. Sunday brings the second day of Odd Camp, rounding off with a live recording of a joint Linux Outlaws and Ubuntu UK podcast episode, which was always stressful and enjoyable.
Like you make it sound like we've done it so many times.
Yeah. Well, it was good fun last year.
Yes.
And we'll be sure to get everybody involved and doing stuff. After that, we'll probably be heading off to some undefined watering hole, I'm sure, for a beer or two to let our hair down, or a Diet Coke, maybe.
Enjoy letting your hair down. I won't be.
Well, those of us who have hair will be letting it down. That's probably going to be a Sunday evening. We'll sure we'll make some sort of announcement during the weekend. But the merchandise has started to arrive as well. Have you seen it? Have you blogged about it, Alan?
Yes. Well, most of it's arrived at Dan's place. So, don't go to Dan's garage and steal it all from Dan's garage, because that's where it all is at the moment. We got some mugs. Mugs were really popular last year.
And these are really slick ones.
They were white last year with black logos on and all the names of all our sponsors. And this year we've got black ones. Dave chose a different type of design of mug. And then
It's a good choice as well.
It is
really
slick.
It
looks really nice.
And you can get your hands on those in return for a £5 donation to Odd Camp. Again, it all helps us keep the event free and costed and funded and stuff. So please bring your crispy fivers along in your little mitts as you turn up.
T-shirts?
T-shirts too.
Yeah.
New this year. We haven't done this before. there will be a limited edition Og Camp T-shirts for in return for a £10 donation. So if you want to get both, you know what to do. But they're looking really, really cool as well. They haven't actually arrived yet, so fingers crossed they'll be there by the time. But the previews look fantastic, don't they?
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of different sizes, so you've got to be really quick to get the size you want.
Yes. Yes. Good luck. But yeah, oh, that sounds fantastic. We have had a piece of a little bit disappointing news, which is that the venue have told us that there's no lifts to the first floor. It was supposed to be ready. They're doing a bit of refurb, and it's not going to be ready in time for the event, unfortunately. And that's where our main stage is. It won't be finished in time for Og Camp. The lift to the basement is working, and the exhibition area is on the ground floor. We have crew on hand to help people if you are in a wheelchair and would like to get upstairs, but obviously it's a bit disappointing that you would have to be carried up and down, unfortunately. But we thought we'd let you know as soon as we could so that you are ready for that information.
None of this could happen without our fantastic sponsors.
Yeah.
That includes Linux Format magazine, who are our media partner, and did a great job last issue of printing our advert.
Big
advert. And then they've done a little write-up again this month.
Yeah, thank you very much indeed. It's great. Yeah,
really good. The Open Learning Centre, the Allens.
The Allens.
Who are also coming along and helped us out in lots of ways. Linux Emporium.
Providing us with Wi-Fi.
Yep. Doing our Wi-Fi for us, yeah.
Fantastic. OpsView.
Who are a sponsor.
Marvellous. Bitfolk.
Who are also a sponsor. We'll be sponsoring the refreshments.
And Andy will be there.
And Andy will be there.
Andy did offer to help set up.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, he's a top man. I love our sponsors. Recruit 12.
Yep, who are sponsoring us, and they are a recruitment agency.
Mm-hmm.
Specialising in IT geeky people.
Linux Fund.
They run a credit card company.
Yes, that helps donate to open source software as you're doing it.
And there's an extra one. How do you pronounce that, Laura?
Exibo.
And what are they doing?
They're putting together some digital displays for us. So John, the nice guy, Spriggs, is writing us some software. And
He's a
very, very nice guy.
For those who were at Elcamp last year, he was the one who got very wound up about PokeBook.
Oh, yes.
And had the fantastic Stormtrooper t-shirt.
Sparkly Stormtrooper, yeah. Right.
But yeah, Exibo are putting together the displays, and so we can hopefully have a display around with the schedule on the updates without somebody needing to go down and scribble on the post-it notes with a marker pen.
Excellent. The high-tech approach.
Yeah, it's a more high-tech approach.
Are Exibo making our crew redundant? Is that what's happening?
No.
No.
I think there's going to be plenty for them to do.
There's going to be lots for them to do.
Yeah, excellent.
So if you're excited as we are about Og Camp, join us in #OgCamp on the Freenode IRC network or our Facebook event page. You can find links to all these things on ogcamp.org. And the Twitter Identica tag for the weekend is going to be #OgCamp. So we'll see you there.
I've said over the last couple of episodes, I've been doing a little bit of developer work bug. That just doesn't sound right. I'm doing developer work. I've been looking at bugs and things. Now, everybody knows that Ubuntu comes from Debian.
Yeah.
That is that we, at the beginning of a development cycle, somebody grabs Debian.
Does a runner with it.
Does a runner, takes it over to Ubuntu and says, right, this is what we're going to base things on for the next release.
Okay.
Okay, so lots of work is done by the Ubuntu team. And then we start getting into bugs and things. So everybody goes off, files their bugs on Launchpad. Well, some people do. Some people can't get their heads around it, Tony.
Thank
you. But there you go. And then the Ubuntu team starts working on those bugs. Now I've got a bit of an issue. And the problem is that there's a ton of work goes into Ubuntu. And there's loads and loads of people. I mean, There's a group called the Bug Squad, which are people that essentially triage bugs. There's 1,000 people there.
Wow.
There's actually a little bit more than that, but anyway. And so the Bug Squad triages all these bugs, and the Ubuntu developers work on them. Mm-hmm. And then we push them to Debian. However, that's not how it should work.
Really?
Yeah.
How should it work?
Well, I've worked on a couple and gone into IRC channels and said, look, I found this bug and I've done a little bit of work. What should I do? And at every opportunity, everybody says, right, what you need to do is you need to go to Debian and file a bug there.
Uh-huh.
Well, hang on a minute. I want to work on Ubuntu. Yeah. Yeah.
That depends. What package are these packages that are, that come from Debian to us?
Well, everything comes from Debian to us pretty much.
No, it doesn't.
A lot of, well, everything is in Universe. So,
okay, carry on.
Okay. So, I don't want to work on Debian. I want to work on Ubuntu.
Why don't you want to work on Debian?
Because I want to work on Ubuntu.
Yeah, but working on Debian is working on Ubuntu.
Well, no, it's not. It's working on Debian.
No. So that's the very blinkered way of saying it. Just bloody minded saying it.
Well, no,
if you work on Debian, if you fix something in Debian, that's going to trickle down to the next Ubuntu, isn't it?
Yeah, but I don't want to fix it in time. I want to fix it now. So if I have the opportunity to work, well, no, because everybody is suggesting that I don't fix it on Ubuntu. I fix it on Debian and it will trickle down. But hang on a minute, the bug is in Ubuntu.
Well, it might be in both. It depends.
And so if we've got all these thousands of people just triaging bugs and developers working on the bugs, how many people does Debian have doing exactly the same task?
Well, it depends on the bugs, really. So let's take, for example, you've got a bug in a package that's in Ubuntu, and that package came from Debian, and there's a Debian maintainer for it. So there's someone who looks after the deb in Debian. Mm. And there's also an upstream. So there's someone who wrote the code that isn't a Debian developer, but a Debian developer took it, turned it into a deb, and now it's in Ubuntu as well. And you're in Ubuntu, and you find a bug. You find a bug in that package.
Yep.
Okay, so, or a user finds a bug in the package and they file it in Launchpad. So there's now this bug filed in Launchpad, and the triagers that you mentioned, those loads of dedicated people who sit there and figure out whether it is a bug or not, and whether it's a duplicate of another bug, and whether it's actually intended behavior and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
They might look at that and say, well, actually, that package, the feature that you're calling it a bug, is actually the same problem occurs in Debian. And in fact, someone in Debian has also had that problem. And they have filed a bug in Debian. So it might be that someone's already done that bit.
Cool.
On some occasion that happens.
Yep.
And in fact, in Launchpad, you can link a bug in Launchpad to a bug upstream. Mm-hmm. And those upstream places includes Debian. So you can say, this bug in Ubuntu is related to this bug in Debian. And it might actually be the same thing.
Sure.
As well as that, you can also file bugs upstream. So where it originally came from. So I'll give you an example there. Tomboy, the note-taking application.
Mm-hmm.
If something goes horribly wrong when I'm synchronizing my Tomboy notes on Ubuntu, and it all goes horribly wrong and I lose a note, I think, oh, that's really annoying. I'll file a bug. So I run the relevant thing or press the relevant buttons, and a bug gets filed in Launchpad because that's where the Ubuntu bug software files a bug. Then the maintainer for that, who is Sandy Armstrong, goes and has a look at it, and he says, actually, that's not a bug in Ubuntu, that's a bug upstream. Do you mind filing it? Now, upstream might mean Debian, it might mean Tomboy.
Mm-hmm.
In this particular case, it means Tomboy. So I then go to the GNOME bug tracker, Bugzilla, I log on, and I file exactly the same bug in Tomboy upstream. Now, I could have bypassed all of that, and I link the two together.
Sure.
So they're now linked. And if the status changes in GNOME, it changes in Launchpad automatically. So when Sandy fixes that in upstream Tomboy, that status that it's now fixed is reflected in Launchpad automatically.
But that's a process thing. Mm-hmm. Not the fix doesn't appear in Ubuntu any quicker.
No, not yet. Not yet. But
that's great on a package that is widely used. But what if you've got something that isn't? What if you find a bug in Ubuntu and nobody's found it in Debian?
Mm-hmm. But does the bug exist in Debian?
Well, that's all part of the testing process.
Uh-huh.
If you find that it does also happen in Debian, the guidance that I've been given until today, and I'll come up with the final answer in a minute because I've been quite frustrated by this, the guidance has always been, go and file the bug in Debian, and in theory, you should be working at a Debian level, not an Ubuntu level.
Well, yeah, I mean, are they expecting you to have a Debian in a VM or something to test whether it has the same bug as you identified in Ubuntu in order to be able to file it?
I mean, essentially, that's what I've been doing. I tweeted about it. And so I have been doing the testing on Debian as well, but it's a little frustrating because I don't want to work on Debian. I want to work on Ubuntu. Yeah. And that's where my frustration has come, because everybody's been saying, yeah, go and do it in Debian.
The key problem is, well, not problem, the key thing to remember is we don't exist without Debian. We have nothing without what Debian have built before us.
Okay, absolutely.
And so it makes total sense, and it's responsible to feed back to them, because it reduces the amount of duplication of work later on.
Okay, so
for example, if we patch it in Launchpad, okay, let's say we patch it in Ubuntu and we fix that thing, but we don't go upstream to Debian and fix it upstream, that means there's a delta between what's in Debian and what's in Ubuntu, and that has to be resolved the next time we synchronize that package from Debian.
But shouldn't there be a mechanism to push those fixes in Ubuntu back up
There is a script called submit to Debian.
Excellent.
And it does.
What does that do?
Have a guess. I did it myself. I've got one patch in Ubuntu, and it's one line. And I went through exactly this process about a year ago, or whenever it was, and I still harp on about it. And basically, I found a bug in Ubuntu, and it was in a script, and I spoke to the developers, well, not script, in a C program, and I spoke to a couple of developers, Daniel Hoback, James Westby, and Ian Lane, and they all said the same thing, file it in Debian. Mm-hmm. Because the person who maintains that Debian package, that .deb package, there's no one responsible for it in Ubuntu. The person who's responsible for the creation of that .deb package is a guy, Joey Hess, in Debian. So it makes sense, given there is someone who's looking after that and who cares for that package in Debian. But there's nobody, no physical person who cares for that package. It's all automated scripts in Ubuntu. It makes sense to pass that up to him, and he can say yes or no, that's good or a bad patch, or that's good or a bad, you know, fix, or no, that doesn't need to be done. And that's exactly what I did. I actually did it in Ubuntu first. I patched the broken thing in Ubuntu. And then once I got that patch working and I could prove that I could rebuild the package on Ubuntu and it worked and there was no problem with it, I then asked James, what do I do with it now? And he said, send it upstream to Debian, because that's where it's looked after. And you run a script and it does it all for you.
But in theory, you should have done it on Debian and not on Ubuntu.
Arguably, there would have been some less work, yes.
Yeah.
Potentially. But the thing is, really, I don't run Debian.
No, but you should. And that's no, why. No. That's why I've been frustrated.
You just swapped arguments.
No.
I'm really confused now.
That's why I've been frustrated, because everybody's saying that you should file it with Debian rather than Ubuntu.
Not necessarily rather. I mean, it's debatable. It depends on the package. Like, for example, I've been sat around in the Hash Tomboy channel a lot, and I've been speaking to Sandy, and, you know, I've helped him a little bit. And so sometimes when I look at stuff and I think, is that a Tomboy problem or is that an Ubuntu problem? For example, Tomboy in Ubuntu is different from Tomboy upstream, because it has the, or it was at some point, because it had the patches to make it work with Ubuntu 1 synchronization. Yeah. Now, Sandy has taken those patches and put them into upstream Tomboy. But it's only because we fed them up to him that happened.
Is it? It seems a little counterintuitive, particularly, again, as for new users, as we've talked about before. If I'm in a restaurant and I'm having, I don't know, a steak, and I find there's a problem with the steak, it's not done the way I like it or whatever, I complain to the restaurant. Uh-huh. They don't go, well, actually, you need to go and talk to the butcher who's around the corner in another street, uh-huh, and you go and complain to him about the...
But nobody's saying you should have to do that. You can.
You've got the option of complaining.
You can do that.
This is more about fixing it than being the end user.
Yeah, the end user can be a fire and forget process.
Okay.
Like, I found this bug. I've done my bit of responsibility, which is click the button that says send this to Launchpad.
Right.
And then it's up to the triagers and the developers to decide what they do about that.
So this is
it's the chef or the owner of the restaurant's responsibility about whether he takes that on himself and says, okay, that was a bad bit of meat, my fault, and I won't, you know, maybe I'll get it from somewhere else. This analogy is going way, way
a bad, doing well.
What is it they say? A bad analogy is like a leaky screwdriver. That's one of Hugo's best ones. So it depends on the package. Now, one useful thing is, there's a thing called the upstream report. Mm-hmm. And the upstream report, I'll put a link in the show notes. If you go to that, it's a report on Launchpad, it actually shows you all the packages that are in Ubuntu. It shows you how many bugs there are and how many of those bugs have got upstream equivalents, are linked to upstream bugs. So you can see when there's a big delta. And that is, you know, if there's a big delta, then we're not being responsible in sending our patches that are appropriate patches upstream.
That kind of leads me on to, with all these people working on Ubuntu and the financial backing of Canonical and what appears to be less people working on Debian, why isn't the role reversed? Why, I know that Debian came first, but why don't Debian feed from Ubuntu rather than Ubuntu feed from Debian?
I'm not entirely convinced there are more people on working on Ubuntu. I think you'll find there's actually a fair overlap between them. For example, there are people who work on, there's a team in Ubuntu working on games packages, and there's a team in Debian who work on games packages, and there's actually, it's the same people. So there is an overlap between Ubuntu and Debian.
I know that Canonical have employees working for Debian.
Yeah,
we've covered that before.
Yeah, lots of people who work for Canonical, like the release manager for Ubuntu is a Debian developer. The guy who wrote the installer is a Debian developer.
Yeah.
You know, these are. So I don't think it would be productive to turn it on its head. I think it's right that we feed from Debian because they have that quality product that we pull from and we build on and we add our stuff, our magic sauce or whatever.
Sure.
Hmm. So what happened the other day or today to change your...
There's a big patch review coming up next week, and I've been looking at some of the documentation for that. And I asked loads of questions of the guys, Daniel Holbach and Nigel Babu, who are sort of getting the documentation together. And it spoke about important bugs. And I asked the question, they said, well, look, there's a point where you fix it in Ubuntu first, and there's a point where you fix it in Debian first, and essentially it comes down to the importance of the bug, and that really is as simple as it is. Somebody sets the importance, and if it's, and this may change, if it's medium and below, it goes into Debian first, and if it's high and critical, it goes into Ubuntu first. So that's it. I mean, that literally did just take my frustration away completely, because it's simply
all your bugs
laid
down there.
Yeah, they are, but
it gives you guidance.
And that's exactly,
I mean, obviously there's wiggle room there, and some bugs go to Debian.
You're upsetting Simon now. So there's no wiggle room.
No.
That's the rule.
These are the rules. Okay.
So
what about Tomboy then?
Is that critical or that severity based on the impact to the user?
Impact on the
users.
Sorry, yes. Yeah. I use the user in the
And there's a page that defines what a medium level and a low level and a high level is, and that is
right.
The critical point in the whole process of triage.
Sorry, Laura.
Sorry.
That's the whole
all
critical
the air
point.
Just went out of the room.
My ears popped. Oh. And that really is the most important part on whether you go into Ubuntu first or Debian first.
I think my key thing would be take advice. The guys in the Motu channel are clueful people.
And do you know what? They are incredibly nice and helpful.
They are unbelievably nice. Yes. And I have found I actually get a fairly consistent answer from all of them.
Yep.
Send it upstream to Debian, whatever it is.
Well, if you've got experience of trying to triage bugs and sending them to either Debian or Ubuntu or the upstream developers, give us your feedback. You can email us at podcast@ubuntu-uk.org or via any of the other methods you can find on our website.
And now it's time for a bit about Ubuntu. So the Launchpad single sign-on is now being open sourced.
Mm.
Is this the OpenID broker, amongst other things?
Yeah,
it's the bit you see with an orange "Yes, sign me in" button when you sign into Launchpad or Ubuntu One or associated stuff.
I see they've released it under AGPL3, the Afro GPL, as people like to call it. It was the only bit that wasn't open sourced when Launchpad was open sourced, wasn't
no,
it? Is
the,
that right?
I think the sign-on was open sourced with Launchpad, but this has been added since then or something, from what John was saying.
Oh, okay. All right, but it's nice that another chunk of code's being put out there. I guess people could now integrate that functionality in their own sites.
I guess so.
Projects. Well, always good.
Well, it's also nice that you get visibility of the code, so peer review, you know, because it's a heavily used single sign-on thing, and, you know, there's potentially your credit card details behind it if you're buying music from the music store. And there's all your SSH keys and all kinds of useful information that could potentially be in there if you're using file sharing or, you know,
Yes, and with the sort of integration of things like the music store and increasing projects in the Ubuntu One field, I guess it's kind of affects more and more people as particularly as the next release comes up, when everybody will be buying their music using Ubuntu One.
Actually, do you know, on the way here, I was listening to music on the radio and I thought, I must buy that track on Ubuntu One, and then I forgot to do it.
I see there was a bug filed about it not being open source, and three people have said it affects them.
Just three?
Just three.
Wow. I thought there were more people using Ubuntu.
Yeah.
Clearly not. The Canonical design team have opened up and published a load of documents about their plans for the future. And there's a new aggregated blog for the design team. Mark Shuttleworth has also blogged about this. And it covers quite a lot of ground. And kind of some of it's interesting. And
For a start, design.canonical.com, which is where the design team are now blogging, looks very swish.
It does.
It's got all the new branding and things on it. And there's a slightly different version of Canonical, as in the word Canonical. It's like it's been rebranded along with...
It has been.
Yeah, but with the kind of O it's that's got filled in O.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. That's the new one.
Oh, that looks very nice as well. So people like Matthew Paul Thomas are blogging on there.
Ivanka.
And Ivanka's on there, and a whole heap of other people. The particular thread that we're talking about here is the first one that we've clicked on, for example, is the farewell to the notification area, with Matthew Paul Thomas saying that the notification area, aka system tray, which everybody calls it, even though it's nothing to do with that.
And he gives the whole history of why it was called notification area and how people didn't use that name.
Yeah, but that's going away. Mm. But yeah, so it's nice to have a place that there is going to be discussion about the design elements, because that was some of the criticism over the new branding, as it just got dumped on it.
Yeah, I think part of this is a response to the criticism they had about things like the buttons and the theme and the rebranding and stuff. So yeah, they're working on it. Okay, it would have been nice to have this 6 months ago, but you know,
hey-ho.
Yeah, it's good for the future.
I wonder how far in advance they're going to release information.
Well, this stuff they're talking about, stuff that's going to be in not just 10.10 but also 11.04, some of the plans they've got for, you know, next year.
Yeah, but that's slightly different. That's not really what I asked. What I meant is how much time are we going to have before these things change? Because, of course, it's in a commercial development, so they're not going to release their new plans that too soon before they make the changes, I'm sure. They are going to keep us informed, but not that far in advance.
I'm sure there'll be a couple of surprises in there just to keep things interesting.
Yeah.
And as part of that, there's some changes to the battery status. A addition of a battery status menu.
Yeah, I quite like the look of this.
Yeah.
Mac.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
You click on the thing in the corner of the screen on the Mac and it tells you how much battery life your keyboard has, your mouse has, everything.
I've not seen that on a Mac, but the example sort of mock-up menu that we've got on the web page is...
Does it have a picture of a mouse and a picture of a keyboard, by any chance?
It has a picture of a mouse, it has a picture of the laptop battery and an iPod.
Ah, okay. So something else you might have plugged in that has a battery in it, yeah. It's a great idea. So you can, anything that's got a battery, you just click one place, see all the batteries in all your devices.
Yes, I do like the idea, as somebody who charges. One of the things I like about Ubuntu is that I can charge my iPod and I have an iPod. I charge my iPod and still use it as an iPod. You can have it charging while you're using it, whereas not on Windows it mounts it and you can't do anything else with it until you physically disconnect it.
Speaking of which, I discovered my printer has a USB port on it for plugging the camera in so you can offload pictures and print them directly from the camera. And also the printer is connected via USB to my PC, which means I lose one of my USB ports. The really cool thing is that USB port on the printer can be used for charging stuff. So I charge my phone off my printer.
Cool, nice.
That's cool.
I wonder if this would be able to detect my phone all the way through the printer and into the phone.
No reason why it shouldn't.
That would be good.
Sounds fun.
Yeah, I'll file a bug when it doesn't.
So Jono's been blogging about having a power user community, which I think sounds quite a cool idea because... Especially with all these design changes recently, I think a lot of the complaints come from people who are kind of power users in the sense that they're quite happy to tweak things and make things as customized as possible.
So have a power users community and then ignore them. Is that what you're saying?
No. Just lump them all in a box in a corner and they can complain to themselves.
Yeah.
He's looking for somebody to lead the community. I assume he's still looking. That's what his blog post says.
and yeah, step forward, yeah,
and try and pull together a lot of hints and tips and how you pimp your PC. And
it's a tricky one. I would you say you're a power user?
I guess I used to be. Now I don't care so much. I just use my computer. I guess I am a power user, really, but I don't care.
It's all relative, isn't it? Like, relative to my mum, we all are.
Yeah, yeah.
My mum has been using a computer for a week.
I say I have the capability to be a power user, but on the whole, I don't bother. I think that's where it put me.
I guess it depends how you define power user.
Well, anybody who likes to pimp their laptop to some extent.
Really? Is that how you would define it, or is that how Jono defines it?
No, that's me. I don't even change my desktop background.
No, I don't either.
I'd agree with Laura, actually.
Well, it's about how much change you make.
Mm.
It's about how deep you get into things. If you're just going to sort of, use Ubuntu as it comes, then you should use it. But if you're going to get in there and change things and move things around and make change to the system, then, yeah, I think you are a power user.
Okay, so it's all about change, or is it all about using the keyboard instead of the mouse?
No, it's making it so that it suits you down to the last little inch, potentially. I used to be a Windows power user. I used to customise all kinds of stuff on there.
I think I probably was.
I've kind of gone off bothering.
I've got a question. With Jono suggesting that this community gets established, is it sort of saying that essentially Ubuntu isn't for those people?
No.
I think he said that it can appear that to those people that it's not for them anymore.
Mm.
And what I think he's trying to say is that, yeah, all right, out the box, it's as simple and as lightweight as it can be. But the idea is they can pull together all kinds of tips and how you do
so is this
yourself.
To rescue the people that we normally lose to Arch Linux or
I think this is
Linux
actually,
Mint or something.
Sneaky in that I think he's just trying to get another bit of the community together, gathered in a corner over there, and then you can actually sort of
get them
encourage
to do
them
your
to
bidding.
Do things. Yes. You know, so well, you know, you guys are you all use Ubuntu to a certain standard. You're actually in a position to give back. Some of you guys go there and do a bit of documentation. Yeah, you're not quite smart. Maybe you could do a bit of development.
You're so cynical, Simon.
I'm not cynical. I think I can
see
what
he's
doing.
It's a great idea. I think it's a good idea to have all these people who you know, have a lot of experience. Maybe they could, as part of that power user community, drive some better support or drive better, you know, answering launchpad answers or being better bug triagers because they're power users of the system and they know it better.
I think it's going out to try and get re-engage those people who probably are the beginnings of Ubuntu. They were a necessity to getting it going. And now you can tell by the reaction of some of the things like the design work, they're feeling pushed out of what Ubuntu's aimed at.
Mm.
And I think this is just a way to re-engage them and get them feeling part of the community again.
Mm.
Communities within communities.
Good stuff.
It's important, you know. We've got Ubuntu women going. I'm seriously into the Ubuntu handbit. You know, it's important.
Mm. Yeah, interesting stuff. Have to watch how that one develops. A while ago, in fact, was it season one? We interviewed Phil Newbra about Crunchbang, which was an Ubuntu derivative designed to use OpenBox rather than any of the other GNOME desktops or other things like that.
Mm-hmm.
He's relaunched the project. But it's no longer an Ubuntu derivative. It is now a Debian derivative, ignoring the fact that arguably anything that is an Ubuntu derivative is a Debian derivative.
Yep.
Putting that on one side for now, which is a bit of a change because he was kind of committed Ubuntu tweaker and developer and person.
Yeah, and there's a nice interview with him on a blog, and we'll link to that. And he gives some detail about why he switched to basing on Debian. And he's pretty honest about why he prefers the development process on Debian.
I'll just read a short snippet out, which says, "Unlike the Ubuntu project, Debian does not have a commercial sponsor with any commercial interests. This was never an issue for myself until recently when Canonical seemed to have become less of a sponsor and more of a governing party. I know this is debatable, but I believe that some of their recent decisions might not necessarily have been made with the best interest of their users' community at heart." He also has some technical reasons about the development cycle and why it's better for him to use Debian than Ubuntu as the base.
I'm not convinced it will make that much difference to a user.
Yeah.
It'll be the same kind of good-looking, slick user interface, nice and lightweight, still Deb package-based. Mm-hmm. So everything's going to work just the same, I think.
That's interesting that he's kind of kicked it all off again and obviously putting a lot more energy back into it. And
good stuff. Good luck to him.
Yeah.
A new derivative is in private beta. Peppermint OS, which is based on Lubuntu and takes some elements from Linux Mint, offers a cloud-based distro, which is currently not available for download because it's in private beta.
Ooh. The website says it is sleek, user-friendly, and insanely fast.
Mm.
So is that a distro that sits in the cloud, or is it a distro that accesses a cloud, or both parts?
It's like Jolly Cloud, which is another cloud-based distro, and I think all of these cloud-based distros are basically the same thing, a bit like Google's Chrome OS. So it's predominantly browser-based.
So it's the client end of it.
Yeah, it's the client end and access it to various web-based services, and they're using the same thing that Jolly Cloud does, which is Mozilla Prism, which is a plugin for or add-on for Firefox, which lets you go to a website, and when you press a button, it creates a separate window for that application. So it looks like that's an application.
Oh, right.
So, for example, if you went to Gmail or whatever your webmail thing is and you create a Prism window, then you can alt and tab between applications, but they're actually just web apps. It's quite it's quite cute, but it's not exactly revolutionary.
I'm not doing anything that things like Jolly Cloud don't already do.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is that Ubuntu, we were talking last time, is kind of is trying to combine the best of both worlds with this idea of, is it Zopa?
Zoho.
Zoho. Moving to having the cloud access on the desktop when you need it, when you want it.
Yeah, so arguably you could do exactly the same thing that Peppermint OS and Jolly Cloud do with Netbook Remix. Now, Jolly Cloud does have some social features, like I could, if I'm a friend of yours on Jolly Cloud and we're both using it and I install, you know, some application, then you get to see that in your timeline. So you might think, oh, Alan's installed that. Oh, I trust his opinion. Therefore, I might install it and have a look at it. You know, so it has some social features that others, that Netbook Remix and Standard Ubuntu might not have. But I don't know. Maybe just, that could be added to Gwibber.
Just going to say, just give Gwibber time.
Yeah. Yeah, you could link the Software Center and Gwibber so that whenever you add an application, it fires it across and then your friends are there you go, and that's Jolly Cloud out the window. What's next?
What is next, apparently, are lots of people who are blue and 8 foot tall.
Ah.
Dustin Kirkland. No, I mean, Dustin Kirkland isn't blue and 8 foot tall.
No, far from it.
But he has but he has blogged about Avatar, the famous 3D film, which was apparently all rendered on servers running Ubuntu.
Yeah. He blogged about this a little while ago, but I think it's resurfaced because the DVD and Blu-ray discs are out of Avatar. Of course.
And have been the best-selling DVDs in the US.
Really?
Yeah, where they really didn't like
it. How bizarre.
Mm.
Fantastic. Yeah, so apparently Avatar was rendered on 4,000 HP servers with 35,000 cores.
Yeah, and I also saw that Jonathan Riddell from the KDE Kubuntu, you read my mind, has also blogged about it because he said that they also used Kubuntu on their desktops.
Ah, yes, that's one thing they do mention as well, actually, yeah, is that 90% or something of the company, Weta, W-E-T-A, the company who made the film, running Ubuntu on their desktops as well, or some version of it.
That's pretty awesome, man. Yeah,
fantastic.
That's like normal companies doing stuff on Ubuntu.
And it's another creative company as well.
Why haven't we heard about this from the company?
Oh, no. Oh, yeah, they did. It was a... Dustin heard about it at some conference,
right,
and a guy from the company said, this is what we did, and this is the hardware that we used to do it. It was a technical conference, right, I think. But yeah, I don't know if they're going to put it in a press release. It's not really interesting to most people, I guess. Right. Most people, you know, don't really care how the pixels were made. It's just, you know, it's a film.
Sad losers like me.
And me. The Ubuntu Women Group have launched a photo competition looking for examples of young girls, that's toddlers, through to 12 years old, playing with and loving and being encouraged to pursue Ubuntu. This would allow parents of girls to demonstrate that it really is okay to be intrigued by the shiny screens, blinking lights, tappity-tap of keyboards, and faint whirs of computer fans. Prizes include a netbook and a bundle of Ubuntu swag.
Swag.
Yeah. So basically all they want you to do is, if you've got a daughter or, you know, someone in your family who uses Ubuntu, and get a photo of them enjoying using Ubuntu, you know, not beating the screen up.
Crying.
Yes, I wanted Windows.
My RAID 5 array won't defrag.
Yes.
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea to kind of reinforce, positive reinforcement.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's good.
don't know where they're going to use the images that they'll get out of the competition, but I assume they've got some.
I'm not sure, but we'll put a link to the announcement and the details.
That's all in the bit about Ubuntu this time.
Chris Blow heard us talking about Bingo on the last episode and asked,
do you know of a Bingo package? I assume there'd been one in the default Ubuntu repositories. I had a look but could not find one. If not, I think now is the time for me to learn some Java / Ubuntu packaging skills.
That's a very good idea.
So what would a Bingo app do? Just like print random numbers on the screen?
Random.
Can you not just do cat dev random?
Yeah, when you start to label bingo balls with hex.
And print them really quickly.
And shout home every so often.
Home? House. Is that what you shout? Was that humour?
Do you know what?
No, did I miss that? I'm sorry.
God. Laura just out-geeked Alan. That's quite spectacular.
Well, no, I'm just being...
Oh, I get it. Sorry.
I'm wondering why Chris said he would specifically use Java. Whether there's an existing whether there's an existing package, he's talking about packaging up an existing Java Bingo app.
Could write it in Mono and really go for popularity.
This is what could make the Linux desktop.
What, Bingo apps?
Yeah.
Well, he could use Quickly to create it. Opportunistic bit of development there.
Yeah.
Python, GTK, job done.
Matt McGraw emailed in to confess,
I'm a stay-at-home dad from Northern California and a huge Ubuntu fan. I discovered the UK Ubuntu podcast at the beginning of season 3 and I'm totally enjoying it. Plus, I have a little radio crush on Laura. Smiley face. Aww. Thanks for bringing us all that is Ubuntu each episode. Keep up the good work. Good guy. Oh, God. Keep up the good work. You guys rock. Oh, thanks very much,
Matt. Thanks very much, Matt. Glad you're enjoying the show. Can listen to all the archive as well.
Yes, you are now obliged to listen to all our shows.
Patrick Mattson from Sweden was wondering,
I understand that part of what makes a distribution special is the applications they chose to be included in the default installation, but I would be very happy if there was an Ubuntu version which only had the minimum of applications. I was thinking of Nautilus and Firefox and not much else. From there, I could add the applications I need. Do you know of any distro that offers that?
Yes.
Do we know? Oh, that was very quick.
SUSE. They have a SUSE builder thing. You go to their website and you pick which applications you want, and you hit a button and it'll build an ISO image and or a USB image, and if you want, a VMware image as well. And you can actually hit the button once it's built the image and try it out in the browser, actually log into it remotely or download it.
It's called SUSE Studio, isn't it?
That's the thing.
That's the one.
So I know people have suggested that we should do the same thing.
You can get a minimal. You can get a minimal Ubuntu installation because I used it
Off the alternate CD.
Yeah.
Yes, you can. It's got like next to nothing on it. Not even a GUI.
No.
Yeah. Although I did notice that he says, I was thinking of Nautilus and Firefox and not much else. Some people would even argue to get rid of Nautilus and Firefox.
Yeah.
So you're better off starting with nothing actually and working up from there.
Why do you need a GUI? You can just use e-links.
Absolutely. Or W3M.
Or have a bot that emails you the content of web pages.
Your name is Richard Stallman and I claim my £5.
How could you tell? Peter Cannon sent us a long rant about the experience of new users to Linux.
I'm in two minds about the points you raised. The badge of developer seems to make certain people hold them in awe, driving them to make allowances for appalling interpersonal behaviour with the excuse, oh, they function on a higher level. It cuts no ice with me. It costs nothing to be civil. A kind word and a pat on the back goes a long way. Having said that, I can see how it'd be annoying for a certain group to receive communication from individuals whose knowledge and understanding may not be as advanced as theirs. This was after your co-worker who got kicked from...
How do we welcome people into the Ubuntu community?
Mm.
Interesting. We've had a bit of feedback, and there's another couple of emails about this one. It does seem to divide the community somewhat, polarizes them.
Mm.
Laura, sorry, you're going to say something?
I was just going to say I kind of agree with him because it's a bit diva-ish, really, isn't it? To give that excuse.
It is, and I don't think it applies. Actually, I've been with the developers for the last couple of weeks, almost a month now, and I haven't run into that kind of attitude at all.
But we mentioned that last time, that's probably because of the code of conduct and the ethos around Ubuntu. If you did the same thing and you wanted to package a similar, whatever it was you were doing, and talked only to upstreams and bypassed all of Ubuntu and Debian, would you have the same experience?
Good question.
Try it.
Well, on that exact...
Leave that as your homework.
On that exact same subject, Sorin Silagi says...
There's always going to be people with poor social skills and a great passion for virtual drama that can't wait for a nice flame war. All we can do is encourage a certain behaviour through culture and guidelines and hope for the best. And in this respect, I think the Ubuntu community is doing rather well. I don't really follow the forums, but whenever I went there for help, the experience has been quite positive.
But that's partly because they enforce a set of rules and guidelines for how to behave, isn't it?
Well, and if those guidelines are working for us and our community, then great.
Whereas the mailing list that your co-worker went on, they were enforcing their set of guidelines by kicking her off.
Yes, I think there's difference between kind of kicking and guidance, isn't there?
I must admit, I'm fairly civil most of the time. But well, today I wasn't. Somebody very close to me, like about an arm's length away from me, sent an email. And it was about 400 lines of quote and one word reply. If I know, sorry, it wasn't you. It was
me. I haven't sent any emails today.
It was the other one.
What, the other girl?
Yeah.
Oh, my life. So about that Ubuntu Women segment. Oh, God.
Yes. What did you do, Simon?
No, he just had a bit of a rant.
I was just like, I just had a bit of a rant. It's fine.
Good, I'm glad.
So we need to enforce the code of conduct within our... Well, yes, that told me. Hugh Sanders sent some HTML email, which defies description, presumably as punishment for something Simon said in the last episode.
Oh, not me again.
I think you said, what's the problem with HTML email, didn't you? And he sent us something that was purple and pink and had ponies in it.
Oh, yes, those straight bizarre ponies, yeah. Apparently there's a website where you can generate those pony pictures.
Really?
Yes.
Put it in the show notes.
Yeah, all right then.
Cesar San Pedro is the art director at Geardrome.com.
We're a company who create games for the iPhone and for consoles. We have previously worked on games such as MotorStorm 2 and Heavy Rain on the PS3, and have recently released a new title for iPhone called Ozone. The art for this game is based completely on Ubuntu, GIMP and Blender. We think Ubuntu is a great OS and have proved it by basing all the artwork on it.
I think that's really good, but...
Yeah, go on.
Let's see if we can release the games for Ubuntu as well as just using it for generating the artwork.
Yeah, I guess they want some revenue.
Yeah, no, that's understandable, but, you know, releasing for Ubuntu as well.
Yeah, when I first saw this mail, it kind of struck me as an advert, and then it wasn't until I read, oh, actually, they did the artwork on Ubuntu.
Yeah, well, it shows that, you know, real creative stuff can be done using GIMP and Blender and, you know, Inkscape and things like that.
Real people really do use Ubuntu.
I tweeted last week, my daughter's doing art GCSE, and she's doing some photography and tweaking the photos and using GIMP to do it.
So brilliant.
Yeah. Wow. In fact, she took her laptop into school and everybody went, yeah, what's that?
Nice.
It's a laptop, you idiot.
Don't have them around their own parts.
It's Ubuntu.
And that's all your feedback. It's the end of a long night. Is it tomorrow yet?
Feels like
almost.
It.
I've only got to get
move.
Up in six
it's
hours.
On camp.
Oh, good. Well, thanks for listening. You can find out how to get in touch with us on our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org, including voicemail and Facebook and Twitter and Identica and all the other stuff.
And the next time you hear from us will be from Og Camp.
It will be from Liverpool.
See you all there.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.